radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities, and radio people you never heard of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you, the human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now, presenting a man whose name, since the beginning of broadcasting, has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
This afternoon, Behind the Mic brings you an explanation of the use of musical bridges on dramatic programs. You'll hear more of that later. The sound effect of the week, we salute radio's first dialect comedian, Henry Burbig. We bring you an actual tryout for a part on a dramatic radio program, a well-known radio editor to answer listeners' letters, and finally, a gripping human interest story as told by Lanny Ross. Few radio listeners realize what an important part music plays on any radio drama. But it does play a most important part, and here is a man who can not only tell you about it, but who will demonstrate with our orchestra some of the different types of music used on radio shows. The man who writes and arranges the music for our program, our orchestra leader, Ernie Watson. Ernie, what part does music play in radio dramas?
First of all, music is used to help set the mood of the drama so that the listener is in a receptive state of mind.
You're talking about music that's used at the beginning of a radio play, aren't you, Ernie?
Yes.
Well, let's show the radio listeners a few examples of how music is used at the beginning of a radio play to set the mood, and incidentally, this will show your ability to write such music, too. Let's suppose we're going to introduce a radio playlet which takes us into the zoo. Now, how would you get us mentally ready for that, Ernie?
Well, first, a little African touch, like this.
Then, a lion. A seal. An elephant. Very good. I almost bet that saxophone player some peanuts, Ernie.
Well, he was imitating a seal. You should have thrown him a herring.
But, Ernie, music isn't just to introduce dramatic shows, is it?
No, Graham. It's more important when used in what we call a bridge. That is, a link in a radio show between two scenes of that play having different locations, or to mark the passage of time between scenes.
Well, Ernie, show us what you mean by using music as a link between two scenes. Let's say a scene ends at a football game, and the next scene is to begin with our hero, well liquored up, walking out of the stadium and down the street towards his home. Now, how would you go musically from a football game to the drunk?
Here you are, Graham. First the football game, then the drunk.
Fine, Ernie. I sort of felt a little touch there myself. Well, anyway, Ernie, here's still another bridge for you. Let's say one scene ends with our hero leaving on a train, and the next scene begins with his train arriving in Scotland. How would you link those two scenes musically?
Like this, Graham. First, the train.
That was marvelous, Ernie. You certainly created an illusion of Scotland. Even that cornet player had an aroma of scotch about him. There, ladies and gentlemen, are two of the most important uses of music on a dramatic sketch, bridges and introductions. And incidentally, Ernie, as long as I mention musical introductions again, I'd like you to set a scene that's really tough. See if you can do it.
Well, what is it, Graham?
Well, suppose a radio play takes place at Coney Island. Could you set the scene musically for us so that we'll be all ready to hear about Coney Island? First, let's hear the gay Coney Island throngs. Prove your strength, boys. Ring the bell and win a box of cigars. All aboard the merry-go-round. What about a roller coaster, Ernie?
It is.
Dropped. I sure thought I was a goner, Ernie. Thank you, Ernie Watson, for showing us the part that music plays in radio drama. And now for another of the unusual glimpses behind the mic that you have come to expect of this program. Probably sometime or other you have wondered how actors or actresses get the parts they play in the sketches you hear on various radio programs. This afternoon, we are going to conduct an actual audition or tryout for a part in a play to be given over NBC next Sunday afternoon. The program is Great Plays, heard on the Blue Network, 3 to 4 p.m. on Sundays. And the audition is for one of the leading parts in the radio adaptation of Molière's The Imaginary Invalid. It will be heard on Great Plays next Sunday. Here is the director of next Sunday's Great Plays to conduct the audition, Tom Riley, who is also a director of television for NBC. Tom, this is actually a tryout for a part in The Imaginary Invalid next Sunday Great Play, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Graham, and we have already selected the male lead, Mr. Charles Webster, who will play the part of Ardan. But I haven't as yet selected the part of Baleen, and we have two well-known actresses here who will try out for that part in just a few seconds.
How are you going to conduct the audition?
Well, I'm going to do exactly what I would do at any regular audition, because that's just what this one is. I'm going to ask our two candidates for the part, Miss Linda Watkins and Miss Marjorie Clark, to read two separate scenes with Mr. Webster and select one of them, the one who seems best fitted to the part of Baleen.
And the one you select will be used next Sunday on the air?
Yes, that's right. Now, Miss Linda Watkins will read the first scene with Mr. Webster. Of course, now, you people here have read the play, but for the benefit of our listening audience, I'll explain briefly that it concerns an elderly hypochondriac, Ardan, who marries a young wife of about 30. Her name is Baleen. She married him for his money in the hope that he will die quickly. In this little scene, Ardan, the husband, the imaginary invalid, is complaining to his wife about a servant, who is called Toinette, who has had the impudence to say that he wasn't ill at all. Now, this is 17th century French farce, so therefore it's somewhat exaggerated as compared to our present-day theater. Now, Miss Watkins, I'll go into the control room, and would you and Mr. Webster please start reading?
And now, Tom Riley is making his way into our control room.
The wench will kill me.
Do you really think so?
Discharge her, my dove. She's at the bottom of all my ills. I say again, send her away.
All servants have their faults, my sweet, and we have to bear them for the sake of their good qualities. I'm sure she meant well.
You've no idea the evil of that wench. Now I shall have to take 20 elixirs to repair my tortured body.
Poor, poor invalid.
No. You are my comfort, my life. And to show you my love, I'll make my will.
Oh, please do not speak thus now. The very thought makes my heart sick with grief.
I asked you for a notary, but you don't want.
Oh, he's waiting outside.
Oh, then let him in, my love.
Alas, my love does not allow me to think of such things. Monsieur de Bonnefoy, come in. Hurry.
Hold it there. Thank you very much, Miss Watkins. Now, Miss Clark, will you read the same part of Pauline, but let's try a different scene. Say, page 12 there in the script. Mm-hmm. Let's see, let's start about the fourth speech down. Now, prior to this scene, Monsieur Ardin has been told by his lawyer that he cannot leave his wife, Pauline, money in his will according to Paris law. He must make a gift of his money to her while he is still alive. And so he discusses giving her some money that he has on hand. All right, Miss Clark, will you go ahead?
Oh, but, sir, you don't know what it means to love your husband deeply.
Monsieur, I'll follow then your advice. In my study, there are 20,000 gold louis and two notes due me and payable to bearer, all of which I'll put into my wife's hands at once.
Oh, no, no, I won't think of it. How much gold did you say is in your study?
20,000 louis, my wife.
Oh, don't mention wealth, I beg you, at such time, my darling invalid. And the notes for how much?
One is for four, and the other for 6,000 louis, my angel.
Oh, all the gold on earth means nothing, darling husband, compared to you. Shall we make the will?
Indeed. We shall go into my study, Monsieur de Bonnefoy. Here, my love. Help me.
Oh, come, come, my poor dear sweet.
Hold it there just a minute, by the way, I have an idea for something, and I'd like to try here. Graham, we got about 30 seconds to spare on the show.
Ed Whitney, our production man, has just nodded okay.
Well, look, Miss Watkins, I wish you'd read the part of Angelique, which has not been cast as yet. And she's a young girl of about 18. She is Ardan's daughter. I want to hear just a few lines of it, and if you'll turn, I think, here it is, on page 6, and read the second speech down with Mr. Webster. Got it?
Yes, I have it.
All right, go right ahead, please.
Thank you, Toinette. I have not seen the fellow, but I hear we shall all be satisfied.
I know it, Father.
What? What? Have you seen him?
I cannot lie, sir. And your consent to our marriage frees my heart. The truth is, we met 6 days ago and fell instantly in love. The request you have received...
That's fine, thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I've heard exactly what I was looking for. Now, it's obvious, I think, that, both of you actresses are very excellent actresses. Otherwise, you would not have been called here in the first place. Now, I don't believe that voice alone is the important thing in casting. It's what's back of the voice that's important. I'm more interested in this instance in a certain mature quality for Baleen, the wife, and a certain youthful quality for Angelique, the daughter. Now, Miss Clark, I want you to play Baleen. For I think that you displayed the necessary contrast between Baleen, the loving wife, and Baleen, the scheming woman who's after the old man's money. Now, remember, this is a French farce. Now, Miss Watkins, your interpretation, brief though it was, is exactly what I think Angelique needs. And so I want you for that part now, please. Rehearsal Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. All right, Miss Watkins?
Thank you, Mr. Riley. I'll be there.
All right with you, Miss Clark?
That's fine for me, Mr. Riley.
Well, thank you both very much.
And thank you, Tom Riley, Charles Webster, and the Mrs. Linda Watkins and Marjorie Clark for giving us an actual behind-the-mic scene. The sound effect of the week. Nearly every week, Behind the Mic presents some unusual sound effect which was used on a program of the past week and tells exactly how it was done. On the program, Salute to Your Birthday, this sound effect was used to denote the crumbling of the wall of an ancient temple. Sounds just like the crumbling of the wall of an ancient temple, doesn't it? This was accomplished in the following way. The sound man has a large hopper or receptacle with a chute attached to it. In this hopper are pieces of rock of various sizes. He also has a turntable in front of him on which there are several recordings of sound effects. One record of the crashing of a stone wall, another of trees falling, and so forth. And now, as he tips the receptacle slowly first, a few large pieces of rock tumble down the chute. A bit more, and a lot of small rocks go down. As the sound reaches the climax, he plays the records, completing the effect. Thank you. Behind the Mic salutes a program you love. We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud, a tradition of good programs that linger fondly in your memory. And so each week we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear, a program you love. This afternoon, Behind the Mic salutes radio's first great dialectician, Henry Burbig, whose hysterical, historical tales brought merriment to millions of listeners. Tonight, in a recreation of his program, The Seco Courier Show, which was on the air from 1929 to 1931, he tells you his most famous hysterical historical tale, The Henry Burbig Program.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We now present Henry Burbig in his famous hysterical historical tales. Tonight, Henry tells you the history of Little Red Riding Hood. Henry Burbig.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you. I'm going to kick over the story from Little Red Riding Puss. There was living in the year $1,866.53. A little girl from the name Little Red Riding Puss. She was living very happily with her marmar and her parpar. But one day it gave her old grandma a sickness in the throat called tonsillitis. Red's mama was a nice little lady, so she called Red over to her side like this.
Hey, Red, come over here. I'll change your profile.
So Red says, okay, mama, old kid. If you're going to beat me, please beat me 8 to a bar.
Stop the jive talk and listen to me, dope. Your grandma's sick. She has a bad case of inflammation fleas on her bronchial tubes. So take this basket of fruits with nuts, with soup, with 4 Roosevelt and 2 Wilkie buttons to your grandma. Don't stop to pick flowers or old Massa Wolf from that old south near the Macy Ginsburg line will get you all, I reckon. Yuck, 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 yuck. Page 2.5, marked down from $1.98. So Red started soon she should go to her grandma's house.
And why I shouldn't pluck maybe a couple Willie the Whippers and Jakey's from the pulpits for my whole sick grandma? I think, I guess I would, I should, I will.
So Red started soon she should pluck all kinds of roses with I'm glad I owe yous, with 2 lips and 3 lips and 4 lips. But just when she was reaching down for a cockeyed Susie, out from the bushes came a 14-carat, no-good, crook wolf, period, no sentence. The wolf laughed. That's the wolf. Ah, my darling Little Red Riding Pants. Where are you going all alone with that pretty basket?
I'm going to my granny's house. If you don't mind that, I'll stick my 2 cents in where angels fear to tread with 2 pairs of Solomon's heels. So the wolf said,
what could be the difficulty with your poor old granny, if I may ask?
You may ask.
I just did.
Then I'll answer. The old buzzard has a bad case of income tax on the pocketbook. Page 2.
Well, slap mine slippers. That's very serial, Red. You better hurry. Goodbye for everything. And the wolf was off like a flashlight to Granny's house. When he got there, he scared Granny out from her pajumpers and jumped into the bed and disgusted his voice. It should sound like Granny's. 1 hour later, Easton standing and sitting down time, Little Red came into the cabin. When she saw the crook wolf in bed, she thought it was her Granny.
So she said, my darling Granny, what big Eddie Cantors you got.
That's better to see you with.
And Granny, what ears you got? They look like a taxi cab with both doors open.
That's better to hear you with.
But Granny, look at your mouth. Those teeth. What big bicuspidors you got.
That's better to eat you with. The wolf jumped out from bed. Red saw Red, and she said, take this and that and this and that and this and that. If you don't like this, take that. And she gave the wolf a 1-2 punch in the punch, and the wolf went for a long sleep into the arms of Morpheus Mufus. So the story ends with the moral. If a rolling stone is worth a stitch in the bush, how many tons does the subway? Answer, 2 tons. Up ton and down ton.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Henry Burbig, for making us laugh again at your hysterical historical tales. Incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, you might be interested to know that Henry Burbig has become a very successful inventor of ingenious gadgets, one of which is a letter sealer, blessed by almost every secretary. We would like to be guided by the wishes of our radio audience in bringing back old favorites of yours. So if you'll drop us a line and let us know what programs you would like to hear, we will try to oblige. And if you enjoyed Henry Burbig this afternoon, drop him a line in care of this program and let him know about it. Letters from listeners. Each week we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and the three or four we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding newspaper or magazine. This afternoon's questions will be answered by Nick Kenny, songwriting radio editor of the New York Daily Mirror. Mm-hmm. Howard Lipton of the University of Missouri writes, "Last week, Behind the Mic did a broadcast from London as its first spot on the show. I read that about a minute before you went on the air, something happened to the London station and you couldn't contact it. The trouble was fixed just as your program began. What would you have done to fill in time if you hadn't been able to get London?"
Behind the Mic always has another spot already rehearsed on the chance that something might go wrong with any remote pickup. And that spot was the first spot used this week. The one with Ernie Watson and his musical Bridges.
Mr. Morris Goldsmith of New York City wishes to know, who selects a program's announcer and orchestra?
On a commercial program, the announcer and band are selected by the sponsor, generally after considerable auditioning. You will sometimes find a sponsor auditioning 10 or more announcers to get one like you, Graham, one that he thinks can best put over his sales talk to the public.
Ora King of East Orange, New Jersey, writes in to ask whether quiz programs are run separately or is there a general clearinghouse used to prevent duplication of questions?
There is no general clearinghouse for quiz programs. Each one is run separately. Generally, someone connected with one quiz show will listen to other quiz programs of the same type to prevent duplication. Once in a while, the same question does manage to slip in and is used on two different quiz programs.
Thank you, Nick Kenny. Thank you very much for answering those questions. Incidentally, Nick, for the benefit of your readers, I'd like to tell you that next week, Behind the Mic will be on the air 1 hour earlier, 4:30 Eastern Standard Time. There is plenty of drama behind the mic, as you will readily believe when you hear the Behind the Mic story told to you by our next guest, whose grand voice gives pleasure to millions, Lanny Ross. The story concerns his present program for Franco-American, on which he is heard 5 times a week. Here's Lanny Ross himself to tell it to you. How are you, Lanny? Before you tell that story about your program, I want to ask and I want to tell you first how glad I am to have you on the same show with me.
Well, Graham, I certainly am glad that you're glad.
Well, Lanny, I'm glad that you're glad that I'm glad.
Well, Graham, I'm glad that you're glad that I'm glad that you're glad.
Well,
in other words, I'm glad.
I'm glad we got that out of our system, and now we'll get into the story. What was it, Lanny?
Well, now we'll just have to calm down here and speak seriously, Graham, because last summer I received a rather pathetic letter from a woman who simply signed herself Grandmother. In this letter, she said,
"Dear Mr. Ross, I'm writing to ask you to do me a great favor. My daughter and her son have lived with me ever since her divorce. This past week, she left home without telling us where she was going and has not returned. Her little son misses her terribly. He cries for her constantly. My daughter used to sing her son to sleep each night with Brahms' Lullaby. You were her favorite radio singer, and she listens to you every night. Would you please sing the Brahms Lullaby on your program? If you do, my daughter might hear it. It might remind her of how she hummed this song every night to him, and she might return home to us. We both miss her so very much."
Well, Graham, that was an appeal that I think neither I nor any other man could resist. So 2 nights later, on my program, I sang Lullaby and good night.
night, creep into thy bed, there pillow thy head. If God will, thou shalt wake when the morning doth break. If God will, thou shalt wake when the morning doth break.
About a week later, I received a letter from a daughter who said that she had been tired of living in a small town and had left home to go to New York City to try to find a job. But she had listened to our program, and when she heard Brahms' lullaby, it had just the effect her mother thought it would. She thought of her son, whom she had sung to sleep with that song, and she returned home. And so, Graham, the family was together again.
Well, that certainly was a most interesting and a most touching story, Lanny.
Yes, but that wasn't the end of it, because another story grew out of this one.
What was that?
I told the first story on my program, and about a week later, I received a letter from still another woman who told me this unusual tale. It seems, Graham, that she was a widow with a small son from whom she had been separated by the necessity of earning a living in a different city. While working in this other city, she had fallen in love with a man who had asked her to marry him. She accepted him, but didn't tell him that she had a son by her first marriage, because she felt that if he found this out, he might not care to marry her. They were driving to the minister to be married, and they turned on the radio just at about the time that I was telling the story about the other mother who had left her little boy and who had returned to him. And so, ladies and gentlemen, this mother has returned to her son, and a happy family has been united. And now for that little family, I'll once more sing the song that they say helped bring them together.
Lullaby and good night.
Turn that off.
Well, what's the matter, honey?
Please turn it off.
Why, sure. Why are you crying, honey? What's the matter?
Nothing.
Well, something must be wrong. Darling, this is the one time when you should be happy and...
Yes, I know it. John, I wasn't going to tell you this. Maybe I'm a fool to tell you now.
Oh, you talk like a melodrama, darling.
I almost feel like one. But, John, you're going to hate me for this. John, I have a little boy, 4 years old. He's living with his uncle. I couldn't have him live with me because I couldn't afford a nurse to take care of him. And that's why you've never seen him. I wasn't going to tell you this until after we were married, but I love you so much. And I felt that you wouldn't want to become the father of another man's son. I know how a lot of men feel about that. But when I heard that story over the radio tonight, how that other mother left her boy, I felt I had to tell you about my little boy.
I see. So you've got a little boy.
Yes, I know I should have told you about him before. Why are you stopping the car?
We're going back.
Oh.
We're going back to get our son.
And when they got married the next day, the little boy was present at the ceremony.
Thank you, Lanny Ross, for a grand human interest story and for your always delightful rendition of Brahms' Lullaby. Will be heard 1 hour earlier at 4:30 Eastern Standard Time. Be sure to listen next week when Behind the Mic will salute an old favorite of yours, the Eno Crime Clues program, with the original cast and more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy, and the drama that are found behind the mic. Remember, next week, Behind the Mic will be heard 1 hour earlier at 4:30 Eastern Standard Time. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
Behind the Mic was written by Mort Lewis. Original music was written and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company.